Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, who assesses congressional responsibility to hold President Bush accountable for his warrantless domestic surveillance program. Danny Schechter, founder of MediaChannel.org, who discusses flawed press coverage of the Iraq War and a campaign he's coordinating to hold the media accountable. And Annie Strickler of the Sierra Club, who examines the legacy of outgoing Interior Secretary Gail Norton's policies on energy exploitation, logging, and environmental protection. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The massive $67 billion AT&T Bell South merger will create the largest telecommunications company in the world. It will provide phone service for nearly half of the United States and be a major provider of high-speed internet service. The mega deal is the biggest unification of former Baby Bell phone companies since AT&T was broken up in the 1980s. Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy complained, AT&T wishes to be the lord over the digital domain, able to impose a raft of tolls, fees, and whatever they term monetization strategies for the Internet. If the merger is approved, AT&T, formerly SBC Communications, which bought out the old AT&T in 2005, would face only Verizon Communications as a major telecom competitor. AT&T also owns the nation's largest cellular communications company, Singular Wireless. Major online content providers such as Amazon.com, eBay, Google, and Yahoo are concerned about the growing clout of the telecom corporations to influence the flow of traffic on the Internet. They're calling for the federal government to require Internet neutrality policies prohibiting telecoms and cable companies from discriminating against any kind of Internet content. Writing in The Nation magazine, Chester warns online users that communications giants are developing strategies that would track and store information on our every move in cyberspace in a vast data collection and marketing system. In an interview with Business Week last fall, AT&T CEO Ed Whitaker proclaimed the Internet was not free. He stated, "We and the cable companies have made an investment, and for Google or Yahoo to expect the use of these pipes for free is nuts." Every morning, 11-year-old Zachariah skips school to help his father meet the quota for tapping latex trees on the huge Firestone Natural Rubber Company plantation in Harbel, Liberia. Rubber workers at Firestone in Liberia report they must tap between 600 and 900 rubber trees a day and say it is nearly impossible to do it without enlisting the unpaid help of children or spouses or paying someone else. Last November, the International Labor Rights Fund filed a human rights lawsuit in federal court in California against Firestone's parent company, Japan-based Bridgestone, using the Alien Tort Claims Act. The suit was filed on behalf of 12 unnamed Liberian workers and 23 unnamed child laborers. The lawsuit claims the workers at Firestone's rubber plantation are at the mercy of Firestone for everything from food to health care to education. They risk expulsion and certain starvation if they even raise minor complaints. International Labor Fund Director Terry Collingsworth feels the case against Firestone is very strong. As he told the website socialfunds.com, the evidence of forced labor is so clear, and Firestone owns and operates the plantation, so it can't foist it off on some offshore foreign subsidiary. In early March, the Republican-led House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to override 200 state food safety labeling laws. The 283-139 vote was a huge win for the food industry that has contributed over $31 million to federal candidates since 1998, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. The San Francisco Chronicle reports Matt Keelan, once a top fundraiser for the bill's chief sponsor, Republican Congressman from Michigan, Mike Rogers, is now a registered lobbyist for the Grocery Manufacturers of America. The bill overturns California's Proposition 65, passed by voters in 1986 to require labels for food ingredients that may cause cancer or birth defects. Los Angeles Congressman Henry Waxman asserts that the purpose of this legislation is to keep the public from knowing about the harm they may be exposed to in food. He explains that the legislation not only rolls back existing law, but takes away the ability of the California legislature to respond in the future to public health crises. consumer advocates and state officials did win one concession in the House debate over food safety. An amendment passed upholding the right of states to issue health warnings on eating fish or shellfish contaminated with high levels of mercury. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Bush's admission that he ordered warrantless eavesdropping of U.S. citizens' international phone and email communication set off a national debate over what to do about his administration's apparent violation of the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The domestic surveillance program conducted by the National Security Agency 4 years ago to deter terrorism prompted calls for a congressional investigation, but the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence under its GOP chair, Pat Roberts of Kansas, scrapped the idea. Instead, the committee created a new controversial 7-member panel that will oversee the surveillance and permit Mr. Bush to carry out spying for renewable 45-day periods without court supervision. But while most Republicans rallied to defend the president, some in Congress believe the president's conduct is blatantly illegal and violates his oath of office. On March 13th, Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, introduced a resolution of censure against President Bush for the spying program, but with the Senate in GOP hands, passage is doubtful. The Electronic Privacy Information Center went to court under the Freedom of Information Act to obtain documents regarding the White House spying program. Court-ordered documents recently received by EPIC reveal that a former top Justice Department official expressed doubt about the surveillance program's legality. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Mark Rotenberg, executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, who assesses congressional responsibility to hold President Bush accountable for his warrantless domestic spy program.
My organization, EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, is very much concerned about the president's domestic spying program. We do believe, as many experts and constitutional lawyers have said, that it probably does violate the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But we also believe that it's important for the public and for the Congress to have a clearer picture of what the Justice Department is actually doing. So we pursued a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Department of Justice in which we asked for documents relating to the program. We were specifically interested in trying to understand what the legal basis was for the Justice Department to authorize electronic surveillance in the United States without the approval of a court, because this seemed to us really a very extraordinary claim on the part of the Justice Department that somehow would be permissible to go outside the framework that was established by the FISA and essentially spy on American citizens within the United States. So that's what our Freedom of Information Act lawsuit is about.
What was the result? I believe you did win in the court, and some information has been revealed.
Actually, we first of all, on February 16th, we had a very important decision from a district court judge here in Washington. Judge Henry Kennedy essentially ordered the U.S. Department of Justice to provide to EPIC documents relating to the program under the Freedom of Information Act on an expedited basis, which, of course, we think was the correct decision on the judge's part. There is a right in the law to obtain these documents. And this week, we received the first set of documents. Now, a lot of the materials that we received had been previously disclosed. They include the Justice Department's own legal analysis about the program, as well as the transcripts of various interviews with the Attorney General. But we did receive one very interesting memo, and this was actually prepared by the person who was in charge of national security matters for the Department of Justice during the time when the program was undertaken. His name is David Chris, and he's now an attorney in private practice working for Time Warner here in Washington. And Mr. Chris's memo, which was written to a colleague at the Department of Justice, basically concludes that the program that the Department of Justice was pursuing probably did violate the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And we think this is a very important revelation because, of course, he had a great deal of expertise and he was on the inside. And for him to say after he had left the Justice Department that the program violated the FISA is very significant.
Mark, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence recently, through its chairman, Senator Roberts, decided not to conduct a full investigation of this domestic spying program, but instead chose to appoint a 7-member panel to monitor the administration and provide them with a 45-day renewable authorization to conduct such surveillance. What do you think of what this Senate committee has come up with?
I was really saddened by that, actually. I'm afraid that what Senator Roberts has done in this arrangement is to largely give up the role, not only of his committee and oversight, but most critically of the judiciary in making the determinations when the Attorney General wants to conduct electronic surveillance in the United States to be assured that, in fact, he has satisfied a Fourth Amendment standard. And I'm afraid, as I said, that what Chairman Roberts has done is basically sort of cut the courts out of the equation here. I'm hoping at some point that there will be a more thorough investigation in Congress, because I think you need to understand these activities before you try to legislate. And I'm also hoping that the Congress will understand the need for the judiciary to play an active role in making the determinations about when it's appropriate for the government to conduct surveillance and when it's not.
I know you and many listeners are aware that Senator Russ Feingold announced recently that he intends to introduce a measure in the Senate to censure President Bush for violation of laws governing domestic spying, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Is that enough, in your view?
I think, actually, Senator Feingold is correct to pursue this. I think it's a very serious matter when there's reasonable evidence that the president has violated the law. Congress should take some action. Another action, of course, would be impeachment, but I don't think that's a practical campaign to pursue at this point. I think what Senator Feingold is trying to do in his resolution calling for censure is basically to remind his colleagues that, you know, there's a reason for ensuring that the laws are protected and upheld, and that when the president chooses to put aside the laws, as many people believe that he's done here, Congress really needs to act. And it's interesting, whereas Senator Roberts seems largely intent in ratifying what the president has done, which is to say simply allowing him to continue to do it, I think what Senator Feingold is saying instead, let's hold the president accountable for what he has done, which is to violate the FISA.
That was Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Contact EPIC by calling area code 202-483-1140 or visit their website at www.epic.org. As the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq was remembered, protests were held in hundreds of cities across America and around the world. The U.S. occupation of Iraq has been extremely costly for Iraqis and the military occupation forces. A resilient insurgency, government death squads, and growing sectarian violence have contributed to the sentiment that day by day things only get worse in Iraq. A March CNN USA Today Gallup poll found that 60% of Americans surveyed say things are going poorly in Iraq, with 57% saying that the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a mistake. 51% of those polled believe the administration deliberately misled the public about whether Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. President Bush's job approval rating at 36% is the lowest for any president in his second term since Richard Nixon. Many who opposed the Iraq war from the start blame the U.S. corporate media for being an uncritical conduit of misinformation to the American people, helping the Bush administration gain support for its March 2003 invasion. On the third anniversary of the war, peace activists are targeting the media for what they maintain has been deeply flawed coverage of the conflict. Between the Lines Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Danny Schechter, founder of MediaChannel.org, who discusses press reporting on Iraq and the campaign he's coordinating with the anti-war coalition United for Peace and Justice to hold the media accountable.
the anti-war movement, the United for Peace and Justice Coalition, has agreed that media is part of the problem here, that we need to protest against the media coverage of the war, that the media helped sell the war, helped promote it, helped basically misinformed and deceive the American public about what was happening in Iraq, whether we needed to go to war in the first place, and what's happened in the war ever since then. And so protesting against the media, making the media an issue, is something that the United for Peace and Justice is calling for. The media industry has done more jingoism than journalism. It's done more selling than telling. We can do better, and people have to get involved. And now everybody reads a newspaper, they watch a TV show, they listen to the radio, and they're upset with what we're seeing and we're hearing. I mean, this is obvious, but in every single survey, people are saying the same thing. The media has fallen down on the job. So let's push them a little bit to try to do a better job, and we can all do that one way or another, with a phone call, with an email, with a letter, with a protest. And I hope that your listeners will be responsive to this.
Danny, lay out for us, what were the major flaws of the corporate media coverage of the Iraq War at its outset, and then take us to the present moment?
First of all, they accepted uncritically the idea that war was the only answer, that we had to attack Saddam Hussein. Why? Because he was about to attack us. The implication was somehow that Saddam Hussein was tied to 9/11. 65% of the troops, when asked just a few weeks ago why they're in Iraq, they say we're there to avenge 9/11. So deception and misinformation is part of the whole mission over there. People don't know why they're there, what the real strategy of the United States government is, and the various big companies that are profiting, like Halliburton, billions of dollars in contracts, no-bid contracts on this war. So, you know, that's one thing. The pre-war, the run-up to the war, 800 experts on the air, 800, okay, on all the channels from the run-up to the war through the statues coming down in Baghdad, only six opposed the war, okay? 1,618 on air sources, 71% pro-war, 3% critical of the war. 63 former government and present government officials being interviewed again and again and again, and critics of the war, anti-war voices, basically not being heard from at all. So you create an environment where one set of ideas prevails and other sets of ideas are excluded. So that's the first thing. Then the war starts, and we don't really cover what's happening. We basically have journalists embedded with the troops, and they're giving a glowing story of what's actually happening in Iraq. They're giving a one-sided, a pro-U.S. Story about what's happening, all the progress that's being made, and Iraqi voices aren't really heard from very much. And this has been consistent. Civilian casualties downplayed, the invasion of towns like Fallujah and the wiping out of whole communities downplayed, the costs of the war, some 250,000 Iraqis dead, a 500,000 casualties not really reported. The American casualties, we've heard about the 2,000 American soldiers that have been killed, but we haven't really heard about the wounded. And not only the wounded who are physically maimed, but mentally maimed, who have come back and are not getting the treatment they deserve and not getting the attention they need. So we need information. We're not getting information from our major media, unfortunately.
What can citizens do to effectively demand a change in coverage? What really matters to the big TV networks? What really matters to the major newspapers?
Their image matters to them. Their credibility matters to them. They don't like to be thought of as people who are, you know, just going along with what the government says. They don't think of themselves as hacks, as propagandists, okay? And I don't either. I know there's a lot of good people in the media. I'm not tarring everybody with one brush. But I'm saying if you look at the performance of the American media, the coverage of the war in Iraq, you can ask yourself this question. How would a state-run media system have done it any differently? Okay? Let's say we had the old Soviet style. How would they have done it differently? They wouldn't have done it as well. In other words, we had, no matter when you flipped on the dial, the same point of view, the same experts on the air over and over again saying the same thing, and then finding out later they were all wrong. There were no WMDs there. Saddam had destroyed them for his own reasons, of course. He's not a good guy. I don't like him. You know, he's evil, you know, in many ways. However, so was, you know, our government people who basically told the American people, you know, a big fat lie about all of this as a grounds for going to war. And explain this, if you can, you know, to the families who've lost, you know, their children in Iraq and ask themselves the question, you know, was it worth it? What have we gained? You know, the problem is we have to convince ourselves we're not alone in raising these issues, that there are many millions of people who agree with us, and we need to do something about it.
That was Danny Schechter, founder of MediaChannel.org and Global Vision. His latest film, Weapons of Mass Deception, examines the media's coverage of the Iraq War. Learn more about his group's media campaign by visiting the MediaChannel.org website. Interior Secretary Gail Norton announced last week that she's stepping down after 5 years in office. Norton came out of the so-called Sagebrush Rebellion of conservative Republican property rights advocates in the West, who advocated opening public lands for private use and development. When she announced her departure, she said she was anxious to return to the private sector, but many critics say she ran Interior as if she was still working in the private sector. As a result of Norton's policies, public lands are now more open to gas and oil drilling, logging, and subject to weakened environmental protections. In her first 3 years, the number of drilling permits issued by the Bureau of Land Management rose 70%. Although blocked by Congress, Norton persistently pushed for opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and Alaska's North Slope to oil drilling. She also succeeded in derailing bipartisan efforts to limit the use of environmentally destructive snowmobiles in national parks. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Annie Strickler, spokeswoman for the Sierra Club, who discusses Norton's legacy, the timing of her departure, and expectations for her replacement.
As far as the legacy of Gail Norton and kind of the devastation she's left in her wake, I think that the best place to look is obviously Western public land. The Bureau of Land Management, which is under the Interior Department, manages a significant amount of federal property across the West. And so those are the places where we have seen oil and gas drilling become the primary purpose of federal land managers under Gail Norton's tenure. You know, it used to be very much a multiple-use idea that drove public lands management. You know, it was recreation, it was resource extraction, and wildlife habitat conservation. That changed very much to promoting just the extractive industries. So where wildlife biologists for the Bureau of Land Management used to be out there, you know, checking habitat and finding out how wildlife was doing on these federal lands, those folks were actually pulled off those jobs and specifically tasked with expediting energy permits and oil and gas drilling permits. So, you know, you've seen this huge boom in oil and gas drilling on Western public lands at the expense of wilderness conservation and wildlife habitat conservation.
Well, President Bush has finally declared that the U.S. is addicted to oil, but he's focused more on the need to not depend on foreign oil. So it makes some kind of sense to increase drilling for gas and oil in the U.S., no?
Well, I mean, I think the point that President Bush missed in his State of the Union address is that it's not just we're addicted to foreign oil, but we are addicted to oil. And you don't kick the oil habit by going and drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or drilling off our coasts. You kick the habit by making cars go farther on a gallon of gas, by investing in renewable energy, by investing in energy efficiency. You know, these are all things that are going to help wean us off of fossil fuel. The United States uses 25% of the world's oil, and we sit on less than 3% of the world's oil reserves. So we are not going to be able to drill our way to energy independence. And so, you know, the president sat there and told the country, you know, we're addicted to oil, we need to do something about it. And then a week later, he turned around and said that as part of his federal budget, we should drill in the Arctic Refuge. And that was a policy that Gail Norton very much promoted throughout her 5 years. In fact, she was the one who said that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was a flat white nothingness, which anyone who's seen photos of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge know that that's absolutely not the case.
Did she ever go there?
Gail Norton actually went up when she went to the Arctic Refuge. She also went to Prudhoe Bay, which is directly to the west. It's actually such a large industrial complex that it's actually visible from space. And it's the place that Gail Norton and others have always pointed to and said, the oil companies cleaned up their act. They can do this all in a sensitive way. We won't harm the caribou. We won't harm the wildlife. We won't harm the Arctic Refuge at all. And there was an oil spill in Prudhoe Bay about 2 weeks ago that's now turned out to be the largest oil spill in the history of the North Slope oil production. So, you know, I think that proves Gail Norton and proves everyone wrong who is out there saying that they can drill for oil in the Arctic Refuge in an environmentally sensitive way. It's just not possible.
Annie Strickler, what about the timing of Gail Norton's departure? Even though most cabinet officials don't stay through two entire terms, there's been talk about her leaving under a cloud that's related to the Jack Abramoff scandal. Her deputy, Stephen Griles, has left already, and he was a kind of poster boy for someone who was supposed to be protecting the public interest but was doing the opposite. Do you think anything might come of this connection with Abramoff?
Possible. But in all honesty, I mean, it is not uncommon for cabinet members to start departing, in the middle or the end of a president's second term. So I don't think that the timing is necessarily all that surprising. She needs to get back to private life, even though if her private life is representing oil, mining, and timber companies, she never really left it when she came in the administration. But that aside, there are some serious ethics concerns and questions dealing with Jack Abramoff and corruption in Congress that are circling around the Department of Interior, and they stem specifically from when Gail Norton was in charge of the department. Stephen Griles, who has already departed, as you mentioned, was undersecretary at Department of Interior, and both his name and Gail Norton's name are circulating with their potential ties to Jack Abramoff.
Are you hopeful that Gail Norton's successor might be more environment friendly, or do you think the Interior Department could even go from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I think it's both. I think we're fully aware that the Bush administration isn't really planning on changing this direction as far as conservation policies go. So even though Gail Norton will be leaving the department, you know, we don't really expect to have her replacement be anyone who would be friendly towards conservation and wildlife and wildlands protection. We don't really have too many high hopes for who will be her replacement.
That was Annie Strickler of the Sierra Club. Contact the group at area code 202-548-6587 or visit their website at www.sierraclub.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.